Usually when we talk about navigating the world, there's this this expectation of precision, like engineering.
Right, like everything should just be calculable.
Exactly. You get into a modern car, and the dashboard shows you your speed down to the decimal. The fuel gauge shows you the exact range you have left.
The engine temperature is right there in high definition.
Yeah, it's binary, it's clean. You know exactly what matters and what you need to pay attention to. But the moment you step out of that car and into, well, the actual reality of human life,
Oh, the dashboard just completely shattered.
it shatters. Whether you are, prepping for a massive boardroom meeting or navigating global news feeds or even just trying to regulate your own nervous system, we are looking at a landscape of information that is completely opaque.
Yeah, we're flooded.
We're flooded with metrics and signals, yet we're starving for actual direction. We have absolutely no idea what is genuinely relevant anymore.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. I mean, our systems are giving us an overwhelming amount of data, but data is just raw material. It doesn't actually tell you if the direction you're heading in is sustainable or if it's, just accelerating a collapse.
And that is exactly why we are here today. We have an incredibly exciting mission for this deep dive. We are trying to figure out not just how to process the massive, overwhelming amount of information in the world, but how to know what actually matters.
Which is the million-dollar question for, well, everyone listening.
Exactly. So, published exactly today, May 17, 2026, we are looking at a brand new academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Saheli. It's titled, let me get this right, Toward Life Coherence, Wisdom, Relevance, Emotion, Relation, and Repair in the Service of Life.
It's a heavy title, but the concepts are just, they're incredible.
They really are. And I want to be super clear right up front for you listening. We are strictly exploring the ideas within this text today. The paper touches on deeply human, sometimes, politically or socially charged realities, but we are taking no sides.
Right, we're just laying out the mechanics.
We are simply unpacking this profound framework, looking at how it works, and handing the tools over to you. Okay, let's unpack this. Dr. Saheli argues that our world isn't suffering from a lack of information.
No, obviously not.
Right, we have more data than any generation in human history, and we also aren't suffering from a lack of intelligence. So, what is the actual crisis we're looking at here?
Well, the central thesis of the paper is that we are suffering from a crisis of what he calls misrelevance.
Misrelevance.
Yeah. Misrelevance is basically this condition where our attention, our emotions, our metrics, all our institutions and technologies, they organize our lives around signals that do not protect or expand life capacity.
Wow.
So we are building these highly sophisticated systems to solve problems that actually degrade the very foundation of living.
We hear so much about the meaning crisis today, right? You read about it everywhere. People feeling unmoored, disconnected, anxious. They feel like they're lacking an overarching purpose. But Saheli says that's only half the story. Why is the meaning crisis an incomplete diagnosis?
Because people absolutely can, and they do, find meaning in things that are fundamentally destructive to life.
Oh, that's dark.
But true.
Right.
The search for meaning is this powerful human drive, but it's directionless on its own. Like a highly polarized political group can find intense unifying meaning in revenge.
Yeah.
Or a society can find daily meaning in digital outrage. A professional can find profound meaning in pure institutional prestige or, maximizing a specific profit metric, even if it physically exhausts their body and degrades the local environment.
So meaning alone isn't enough.
Exactly. The deeper pathology is misrelevance. It's when we make the wrong things matter, and then we attach our sense of meaning to those wrong things.
So it's like driving that high-tech car we talked about at the beginning, but the dashboard prioritizes the volume of the radio while completely hiding the fuel gauge.
Yes, that's a perfect analysis.
Like the radio volume is accurate data, it's real information. But if you make it the most relevant thing on the dashboard, eventually the car is going to break down on the side of the highway.
That is the exact mechanism. The radio volume in your example is salient. It stands out, it's loud, it demands attention, but it's not life important.
Yeah.
And the paper bases its entire framework on this concept of life capacity.
And we should probably define that because it sounds a little I don't know, a little abstract.
It does, but it's crucial to understand that life capacity isn't some poetic philosophical idea. It's firmly grounded in biology and ecology. It refers to the real biological, psychological, relational, and ecological conditions that allow living beings to heal, to participate, to belong, and to flourish.
So it's very tangible.
Extremely tangible. It's the thermodynamic reality of having clean water. It's the neurobiological reality of experiencing trust. The ecological reality of a sustainable habitat.
This really highlights where intelligence falls short, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, an algorithm can be highly intelligent. A multinational corporation can be highly intelligent, but that doesn't mean they're operating with life capacity in mind.
Right. Because intelligence is essentially just the capacity to optimize outcomes within a given frame.
Right.
You can have a corporation that intelligently maximizes its quarterly profit by extracting resources and exploiting labor. It is solving a complex mathematical and logistical problem brilliantly. It's highly intelligent, but it's optimizing the wrong objective.
So where does wisdom come in?
Wisdom, as defined in this paper, questions whether the frame itself serves life. Wisdom is intelligence made answerable to life.
Wow. Intelligence made answerable to life.
Yeah. Intelligence asks, how do we achieve this goal most efficiently? Wisdom asks, does this goal expand or destroy our capacity to live?
Okay, so if wisdom is fundamentally about knowing what matters to life, where does that knowing actually begin? Because, you know, we tend to think of wisdom as a purely intellectual pursuit, like sitting in a library, pondering grand theories. But Scaley argues it doesn't start in the brain at all, right? It starts in the body.
Yes. The paper builds this theoretical architecture called the Living Triad of Wisdom, and it rests on three pillars. The first pillar is drawn from the work of Catherine Powell Kaufman. Her contribution is essential because it pulls wisdom out of the realm of pure, detached logic and anchors it in biology. She shows that long before we rationalize a situation, before we measure a metric or build a spreadsheet, our bodies are already evaluating the world through emotion.
The paper uses this very specific term for that, right? Viability sensing.
Yeah, exactly. In Peel Kaufman's framework, emotion is not just irrational noise. It's not this evolutionary hangover that interferes with clear, rational thinking.
Which is how we usually treat it.
Right, like, oh, don't be so emotional, be logical. But emotion is a primordial mode of biological evaluation. Hunger, fear, exhaustion, joy, awe, disgust. These are highly evolved biological signals.
They're data points.
Exactly. They are constantly registering whether our organism-environment relationship is safe, whether a situation is depleting our metabolic energy, or whether an interaction is reparative. Emotion is simply viability becoming felt by the organism.
Okay. I want to push back on that a little bit. Because if emotions are just biological signals evaluating viability, they are notoriously unreliable. Like, let's say I have a phobia of public speaking. It feels like a life or death threat. My heart is racing. My palms are sweating. My body is flooding me with cortisol. It is screaming that I am in mortal danger.
Right.
But factually, I'm just standing in a conference room looking at a PowerPoint. Why should we trust that biological signal over pure logic?
That's a great point. But what's fascinating here is that recognizing emotions as biological signals doesn't require us to treat them as infallible.
Okay, how so?
Think of a navigational compass. A compass is designed to detect magnetic north. Mm. But if you place a massive electromagnet next to it, the compass gets distorted. It malfunctions.
Right, it spins wildly.
Yeah. But you don't throw the compass away and declare that the concept of direction doesn't exist. You realize there is a local distortion. Emotions operate the exact same way.
Oh, that makes total sense.
They can absolutely be distorted by unresolved trauma, by severe physical exhaustion, or by absorbing a highly polarized cultural ideology. Your fear of public speaking is a misfiring of a deeply evolved social protective mechanism.
Because my brain thinks I'm going to be kicked out of the tribe.
Exactly. Your brain is conflating social rejection with being exiled, which historically meant death.
So the signal is real, but the context it's applying itself to is mismatched.
Precisely. So wisdom isn't obeying emotion blindly. If you obey the fear of public speaking blindly, you never share your ideas. But wisdom also isn't suppressing the emotion, you know, pretending you are perfectly calm when your nervous system is on fire.
Right.
Wisdom is listening to the signal and asking, what viability concern is this trying to protect? What boundary feels threatened? What loss is being grieved? You don't dismiss the emotion, you interpret it.
Wow. And these emotions, they aren't just private events trapped inside our individual nervous systems. They leak out. They actually dictate how we interact with the physical and social world around us. Which brings us to the second pillar of the triad. The paper brings in the theoretical biologist Humberto Maturana and his concept of emotioning.
Maturana radically shifts how we understand feelings. We're so conditioned to think of an emotion as a private internal state. But Maturana argues that emotions are actually relational domains of action. They physically and cognitively open and close worlds of possibility.
This is a massive shift in perspective. Yeah. So if you are operating from a domain of fear, it doesn't just mean you feel scared inside. It means your entire perception of the outside world literally narrows into a landscape of threat.
Exactly. Every action available to you becomes about withdrawal, defense, or preemptive attack. You can't see anything else.
And conversely, the relational domain of trust opens a completely different world of cooperation.
Right. And Maturana uses a very specific biological definition of love, which Sayeli adopts in the paper. It is vital to strip away our cultural baggage here.
Yeah, let's be clear about this.
This is not about romance. It's not about sentimentality or even necessarily liking someone. Maturana defines the biology of love as the relational domain where the other person appears as legitimate in coexistence.
Legitimate in coexistence. Let's break the mechanics of that down, because it feels like the hinge upon which the relational aspect of this paper turns.
It really is. It means that when you operate from this specific emotional domain, you do not require the other person to be identical to you or useful to you or subordinate to your worldview in order to grant them the right to exist.
Right.
You might profoundly disagree with them. You might be in active, tense conflict with them over resources or policy, but you do not treat their actual existence as a systemic error that needs to be solved by destroying or dominating them.
You know, I was trying to think of a metaphor for this earlier.
Oh, let's hear it.
It's like looking at the receptor states of a cell in biology. When a cell is in a state of severe physiological stress, like the fear state, its external receptors literally change shape.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And because they change shape, they cannot bind with certain nutrient molecules. They can only bind with defensive or inflammatory signals. The cell's physical state restricts its universe of interaction. But when the stress passes, the receptors relax, change shape again, and suddenly the cell can absorb nutrients and communicate with neighboring cells. The environment didn't change, but the cell's relational domain did.
That is a phenomenal biological translation of Maturana's point. The environment, the coworker, the political opponent, the family member, they might be sending a perfectly neutral signal. But if your receptors are shaped by the domain of fear, you cannot metabolize it as neutral.
It binds to you as an attack.
Right. You literally cannot see the possibility for collaboration until the emotional domain shifts. And the paper links this physical and relational reality directly to language. How we name things is how we shape those receptors. Language brings forth realities.
The example in the text about structural harm versus personal failure perfectly illustrates this.
Yeah. Consider a medical clinic dealing with a patient who consistently fails to take a complex regimen of medication. If the medical staff names this problem as patient noncompliance or a personal failure, they bring forth one specific world of action.
The receptors are shaped for blame.
Exactly. The resulting actions are lecturing the patient, feeling frustrated, or eventually just dismissing them from the practice. The solution is entirely focused on forcing the patient to change their behavior.
But if they rename that exact same situation as a systemic burden, maybe looking at the fact that the patient cannot afford the copay, or they lack reliable transportation to the pharmacy, or they are working three jobs and are cognitively overloaded, they open a completely different world.
A world of repair.
Right. Now, the action isn't lecturing. The action is connecting them with a social worker or finding a generic alternative.
Yeah.
The physical reality of the missed medication didn't change, but the relational domain completely shifted.
The problem went from being an enemy to being a shared puzzle.
So, if we are stuck in the wrong emotional domain, if our cellular receptors are clamped down in fear, and we are naming the world in a way that only breeds hostility, how do we ever break out of it? The emotional response feels so automatic. How do we shift the frame?
That requires the third pillar of the triad, the cognitive engine. And for this, the paper turns to the cognitive scientist John Verveke and his concept of relevance realization.
Because we are dealing with a selection problem, we are constantly flooded with infinite data.
Yes, it's called combinatorial explosion. If your brain attempted to consciously process every single sensory detail in your room right now, the hum of the air conditioner, the exact pressure of your shoes on your feet, the millions of visual details, while simultaneously evaluating every memory you have and every possible action you could take in the next 10 seconds, your cognitive system would instantly paralyze.
You just freeze.
Completely. Relevance realization is the continuous self-organizing process beneath our conscious awareness that figures out what is salient, what counts as a problem, and what affordances for action we actually have. It is the filter that reduces the infinite down to the actionable.
And the paper draws a really sharp distinction here between salience and insight, because they are not the same thing, even though we often confuse them, right?
Right. Salience is just what is loud. A breaking news alert on your phone is salient. A loud noise in the woods is salient. But insight is a structural reorganization of what matters.
It's like staring at one of those magic eye posters from the 1990s.
Without a stereograms, yeah.
You're staring at this chaotic, repeating pattern of neon static. Your brain is taking in all the data, and it's highly salient, but it's just noise. And then suddenly your eyes adjust, your brain's frame of reference reorganizes, and a three-dimensional image of a dinosaur pops out of the page.
That is insight.
You did not receive any new raw data. The poster didn't change. But your cognitive machinery realized a new relevance, and a coherent picture emerged from the noise.
And this completes the theoretical engine of the triad. All three pillars dynamically interact and correct one another.
Right.
Pale Kaufman's biology of emotion senses viability, Maturana's relational domains open worlds of interaction. Verveke's relevance realization focuses cognitive attention on what matters. Verveke's cognitive flexibility prevents Maturana's relational worlds from becoming permanently rigid. Insight allows you to break out of a fearful frame.
Yeah, it breaks the loop.
And simultaneously, Pale Kaufman's biological grounding prevents Verveke's cognition from becoming detached psychopathic logic. They keep each other tethered to the reality of the living organism.
Okay, this is a brilliant mechanism, but I have a question. Couldn't a highly functioning authoritarian regime or like a manipulative social media algorithm use all three of these perfectly to control people?
Oh, absolutely.
Because an algorithm doesn't care about your actual flourishing. It just knows how to target your viability sensing with fear-inducing headlines, lock you into a relational world of tribal anger, and shape your relevance realization so that the only thing that matters is scrolling to the next outrage. The engine is working perfectly, but it's driving us into a wall.
The paper acknowledges this exact vulnerability. The triad is an immensely powerful engine, but an engine only provides locomotion. It does not provide a destination.
Right.
Relevance realization doesn't automatically know what is ethically good or ecologically sustainable. It just knows what fits the current frame. If the frame is set by a manipulative algorithm, the engine will efficiently process misrelevance.
Which is terrifying.
It is. That is why the triad cannot operate in a vacuum. It requires external testing. It needs guardrails to ensure that what we feel is relevant is actually true to life.
Let's look at how we test our own cognitive machinery then. The paper outlines three specific guardrails. What is the first test?
The first is the like-value test, drawn from the philosopher John McMurtry. It demands that we look at whatever our cognitive engine has decided is relevant and ask, does this frame, this action, or this metric physically expand or reduce life capacity?
This cuts right to the core of how systems create false relevance. We talked about how intelligence optimizes a frame. Large systems, corporations, bureaucracies, hospitals, they love to expand themselves. They develop their own internal metabolism.
They absolutely do.
Like a hospital administration might prioritize a metric like patient bed turnover rates to maximize efficiency. That matter becomes highly relevant to the system's expansion. But that system expansion displaces the things that serve actual biological life.
Yeah.
Like a doctor having the unhurried time to sit, listen to, and accurately diagnose a complex, terrified patient.
Exactly. The system makes the spreadsheet highly relevant. The doctor's relevance realization is hijacked by the demand to clear the bed. McMurtry's test cuts through that distortion by asking, relevant to life or relevant to the system? If the metric reduces the capacity of the patient to heal, or burns the doctor out to the point of clinical depression, it fails the life value test, no matter how intelligent or efficient it looks on paper.
The second guardrail is Johann Galtung's anti-violence test. We know Galtung's work in peace studies. He famously categorizes violence into direct, structural, and cultural violence.
Right. Direct violence is the physical blow.
Structural violence is the poverty, the unequal healthcare, the systemic disenfranchisement.
And cultural violence is the narrative that justifies it all.
But how does this specifically act as a filter for cognitive relevance?
Galtung's framework is vital here because cultural violence is essentially a weaponized form of relevance realization. Cultural violence trains our brains to look at structural harm and see it as natural, inevitable, or even justified. If you see a marginalized community suffering from severe industrial pollution, cultural violence provides the frame. Well, property's cheaper there, it's just basic economics, or they should just move.
It blinds us to the harm. It makes the suffering of others irrelevant to our own cognitive processing.
Precisely. So the anti-violence test forces us to pause the engine and ask, what harm is this current frame hiding or normalizing? If an economic policy or an institutional procedure looks brilliant and efficient but relies on the structural exhaustion of a vulnerable population, it fails the test.
And the third guardrail is the discernment test, which focuses on the concept of ultimacy.
Yeah, the discernment test asks, what is being made ultimate? What is this system or this individual protecting at all costs, and who is being sacrificed to protect it? Every system has an ultimate concern. A foundational idol, it could be absolute national security, it could be ideological purity, it could be perpetual market growth. If we connect this to the bigger picture, these three tests are what separate mere intelligence from life-coherent wisdom. You can possess a genius-level IQ, you can build the most efficient supply chain in the world, you can architect a stunningly effective political campaign, but if your actions reduce planetary life capacity, if they hide structural violence behind cultural narratives, and if they sacrifice human beings to protect a finite metric, you are acting without wisdom. You are highly intelligent and profoundly unwise.
But history and our daily news feeds show us that we fail these tests constantly. When our relevance realization fails these tests, our attention and our institutions get hijacked. The paper refers to these as failure modes.
Yes.
Dr. Sokili lists six specific modes of capture. And I want to emphasize to the learner listening to this right now, these aren't just individual moral failings where someone just didn't try hard enough. These are systemic psychological traps that scale up to capture entire societies. Let's dig into the mechanics of these. Number one, salience capture.
Salience capture occurs when the sheer volume or intensity of a signal overtakes its actual importance to life. It is the neurological equivalent of a hijacking.
The classic modern example is doom scrolling.
Right? Oh, 100%.
A highly produced, emotionally volatile video of a political outrage pops up on your feed. It is designed with rapid cuts, loud audio, aggressive text. It completely captures your nervous system. Meanwhile, a slow, massive, existential issue, like the gradual acidification of the oceans or the slow decay of local community trust, is completely ignored because it doesn't generate daily high-dopamine breaking news alerts.
Your viability sensing is hijacked by novelty and manufactured threat. You spend all your cognitive energy reacting to the salient while the relevant slowly collapses.
That's terrifying.
Number two is effective capture. This happens when an emotion, which began as a perfectly valid biological signal, closes into an impenetrable relational world. Fear capture is perhaps the most dangerous.
Because it just spirals.
Yeah. Fear rightly registers a local danger. But when a group or a nation is captured by fear, the entire world becomes a landscape of threat. Ambiguity is treated as danger. Difference is treated as treason. This inevitably leads to a desire for total domination disguised as a need for security.
The paper also explores the concept of grief capture, which I found incredibly poignant. Honoring the dead, grieving a historical injustice, these are deeply necessary life-affirming acts. But grief capture can weaponize memory. It becomes a frozen state where honoring the past is inextricably linked to hating the living in the present.
Yes, it's a tragic loop.
And I want to remind the listener here, the paper applies this framework impartially to all human conflicts. It doesn't take sides in historical disputes. It reveals the underlying mechanics of how universally human these traps are, whether they manifest in geopolitics, corporate rivalries, or multi-generational family feuds.
It is a really sobering analysis of human conflict. Number three is metric capture. This is essentially Goodhart's law playing out at a civilizational scale.
Goodhart's law, remind me.
Goodhart's law posits that when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. But the paper explains why this happens.
Because the metric strips away the context of life.
Exactly. A metric is a necessary abstraction. You need test scores to generally understand if students are learning. You need throughput data to understand if a hospital is functioning. But in metric capture, the abstraction replaces the reality.
The map becomes the territory.
Yes. The school administrators start cutting recess, art, and music to drill students for the standardized test. The hospital administrators penalize nurses for spending too much time talking to a grieving family because it ruins the efficiency data. The metric literally becomes a substitute for life. People begin managing the numbers instead of caring for the living organisms those numbers were originally supposed to represent.
Number four is sacred capture. This happens when a finite human concern, a nation state, a specific religious doctrine, an economic theory, or even a university's historical reputation is elevated to the status of an absolute ultimate. It becomes unquestionable.
And the brutal historical reality is that when something finite is made absolute, it inevitably requires the sacrifice of actual living beings to maintain its purity.
Right. The paper specifically mentions the use of spiritual bypass, where transcendent spiritual language is utilized to ignore, justify, or float above concrete material suffering.
Which leads us to number five, algorithmic capture. This represents a novel historical shift in how misrelevance operates. Algorithms are mathematically optimized for engagement. They measure time on page, clicks, and shares, and treat those metrics as the definitive proxy for relevance.
But as we know from viability sensing, human beings are biologically wired to engage with threats, outrage, and tribal signaling. We click on the car crash.
We do. And the paper introduces a chilling term for this, synthetic misrelevance. AI and digital platforms scale engagement capture without possessing any life answerable wisdom. They're structurally blind to life capacity. They degrade human attention, fracture relational domains, and stunt developmental life, all while operating flawlessly according to their internal metrics.
They are optimizing for the machine's survival, not the human's flourishing.
Exactly. And finally, number six, institutional capture. This is the tragic life cycle of almost every human organization. A hospital, a government agency, a charity is built to serve a specific human need. But over time, the institution shifts its primary focus to protecting its own survival, defending its bureaucratic procedures, and managing its public relations reputation.
Often actively harming the very people it was built to serve in order to protect the brand.
The institution becomes a self-preserving vessel, and it entirely forgets the life it was supposed to carry.
This is a devastatingly accurate diagnosis of the modern world. We are talking about our educational systems, our healthcare, our digital infrastructure, and our governments all being deeply captured by these modes of misrelevance. So how do we systematically fight back? How do we break the frame? Let's explore the architecture of the solution. The paper offers two profound conceptual tools, the wisdom compass and the cycle of repair.
The wisdom compass is a visual synthesis of the entire framework. Picture a concentric map. At the absolute center, the bullseye, is life capacity, the continuous protection, repair, and expansion of biological and ecological life.
Okay.
Immediately surrounding that center is the living engine of the triad, emotion-sensing viability, relation-opening worlds, and relevance-realizing affordances. Guarding that triad are the three tests: life value, anti-violence, and discernment. And actively pushing back from the outer perimeter is the shadow ring of those six capture modes.
It is a brilliant map for keeping our cognitive relevance permanently anchored to actual life. But a map is static. To actually navigate through a complex captured system, the paper provides the 11-step wisdom cycle. Now, we're not just going to read a list here. Let's look at how this cycle actually functions in reality.
Let's do it.
Let's imagine a classic scenario of institutional and metric capture. A hospital ward suffering from severe nursing burnout and declining patient care due to aggressive efficiency quotas. How does the cycle begin?
It begins with the body. Step one is sense viability. Before you look at the hospital's quarterly data, you listen to the biological signals of the system. You feel the physical exhaustion of the staff. You notice the heightened cortisol, the frayed tempers, the literal fatigue in the room.
Step two is notice salience. What is demanding attention? The hospital administration is constantly emailing about charting errors and throughput metrics. That is loud, but what is being ignored? The fact that nurses are crying in their cars before shifts.
Then we move to the cognitive framing. Step three is name the frame. This is where you expose the hidden story. The administration has named the problem poor time management by the nursing staff.
Step four forces you to test that frame. Test life value. Does managing time better to hit this metric expand life capacity? No, it just forces faster, lower quality care.
Step five is reveal harm. You apply Galtung's anti-violence test. Who is bearing the hidden structural burden of this efficiency metric? It's the nurses absorbing the moral injury and the vulnerable patients receiving rushed care.
Once the harm is revealed, you have to act. Step 6 is interrupt capture. You have to break the automatic loop. This might mean the nursing staff collectively refusing to prioritize the charting metric over patient stabilization. You stop feeding the machine.
Step 7 is reframe. You change how the reality is visible to the organization. You shift the institutional language from nursing noncompliance to structurally mandated moral injury.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Step 8 is repair. And the paper is adamant that wisdom must culminate in physical, material action. Wisdom is not just achieving a state of Zen enlightenment while a hospital burns down. But Saley introduces a vital concept here. De-implementation. It is the wisdom of subtraction.
This is a profound critique of modern institutional behavior. When an institution faces a crisis, its instinct is always to add. Add a new wellness committee, add a mandatory online module on resilience, add a weekly yoga class.
Which everyone hates.
Exactly. Because if the core workload is structurally toxic, adding a resilience seminar on top of a 14-hour shift doesn't fix the problem. It actually insults the viability sensing of the staff.
You have to stop doing the things that are causing the harm. Subtraction, de-implementation. You remove the redundant charting requirements. You lower the patient-to-nurse ratio.
And this highlights a fundamental dichotomy running through the entire paper, the difference between domination and repair. When systems face friction, they usually resort to domination. Domination imposes order by reducing the agency of others. It silences the complaining nurses. It forces compliance.
Right.
Repair, however, requires immense wisdom because it seeks to restore the conditions for life to naturally flourish. It restores agency rather than crushing it.
To ensure the repair lasts, the cycle concludes with structural safeguards. Step 9 is protect margins. You have to actively safeguard the reserves, the time, the sleep, the financial resources, the cognitive slack that are necessary to prevent the system from collapsing back into capture.
Step 10 is coordinate. You line these actions across different departments without erasing their unique perspectives.
And finally, step 11 is learn and reattune. You stay completely humble to reality. If the repair didn't work, reality will tell you. You listen to the viability sensing again, and the cycle continues.
It is a continuous recursive loop of staying answerable to life.
Let's bring this entirely out of the theoretical realm. How does this architecture apply to the massive structural challenges we are facing globally?
The paper explicitly applies this framework across several major domains. In clinical and educational wisdom, for instance, it demands a total paradigm shift. In medicine, doctors must be trained to look past the isolated biological lab result and evaluate the patient's organism-niche relation.
What does that mean in practice?
That means recognizing that a patient's chronic inflammation cannot be cured by a pill if they are returning to an environment of severe economic terror and toxic environmental exposure. The niche is making the organism sick.
And in education, it means dismantling achievement capture. Instead of designing schools as factories that optimize children for standardized testing, educational wisdom focuses on forming human discernment, fostering genuine curiosity, and building physical and relational belonging. We have to stop optimizing kids for a machine world.
In the realm of public health and governance, the framework points directly to what it calls the commercial determinants of health.
This is a crucial concept. It explains how highly profitable, deeply toxic exposures, like the mass marketing of ultra-processed foods or the deployment of predatory digital apps targeted at teenagers, are culturally normalized. The cultural violence frame tells us it's just a free market, it's personal lifestyle choices.
Right.
But the wisdom framework reviews these as systemic structural harms designed to extract profit at the expense of biological life capacity.
Governance wisdom, therefore, means creating and enforcing policies that actively expand life capacity. It means refusing to adopt policies that simply displace economic or ecological burdens onto vulnerable populations or the natural environment. The paper refers to this macroscopic view as planetary health.
In which naturally leads us to the most rapidly expanding system in human history, artificial intelligence. This is the existential question of our decade. Based on this text, what is the single guiding question for AI development moving forward?
The paper provides a remarkably clear directive. The guiding question for any AI architecture is, does this system help human beings realize what actually matters for life, or does it automate misrelevance?
Wow.
If an AI system is deployed simply to optimize user engagement, to scale outrage, or to provide frictionless surveillance for institutional convenience, it is a catastrophic automation of misrelevance. AI must be made structurally answerable to human dignity and ecological responsibility, not just to algorithmic efficiency.
And finally, the paper applies this to peace building. How does this framework navigate the brutal reality of global conflicts?
The paper touches on this with profound spiritual political wisdom. It draws a stark line between negative peace and positive peace. Negative peace is merely the absence of direct violence, a temporary ceasefire, a heavily militarized border. It is fragile because the structural harms remain.
So what is positive peace?
Positive peace is the actual sustained presence of life-enabling conditions. Achieving positive peace requires seeking justice without succumbing to the capture of revenge. It requires holding immense generational grief without allowing that grief to transmute into a hatred of the living. It demands a vision of security that does not rely on the permanent structural domination of others.
Wow. We have covered an incredible amount of ground today, from the neurobiology of emotion to cognitive processing, from the traps of institutional capture to the guiding ethics of artificial intelligence and global peace building. So what does this all mean for the listener to this right now? How do you take this massive systemic architecture and apply it to a random Tuesday afternoon?
The paper anticipates this need for practical application. It distills the massive 11-step cycle down into what it calls the portable core. These are five simple, piercing questions you can ask yourself in any situation. Before you send an angry email, while you're scrolling through a toxic news feed, or when you are sitting in a meeting evaluating a new corporate strategy.
Okay, let's hear them.
Number one, what has been made to matter here?
Number two, does this actually serve and expand life capacity?
Number three, what hidden harm or structural violence is being normalized?
Number four, what finite thing is being treated as ultimate?
Number five, what specific material repair is required?
I love the clarity of that. It is immensely practical. We simply do not need more information if we lack the discernment to filter it. We do not need more technological optimization if we lack the wisdom to direct it. Wisdom isn't some abstract mystical ideal floating in the clouds. It is a highly practical daily discipline of evaluating reality.
Right.
As the paper beautifully puts it, wisdom is life learning to let what truly matters matter again.
I think we spend so much of our daily energy trying to adapt ourselves to the metrics, the algorithms, and the institutions around us. We attend seminars to become more resilient so we can endure toxic workloads. We try to hack our sleep so we can be more productive for systems that do not care about us.
Yeah.
But what if your exhaustion isn't a sign that you are failing the system? What if your burnout is actually your body's deeply evolved viability sensing, desperately trying to tell you that the system's relevance is fundamentally broken?
That is a massive perspective shift.
It is. Tomorrow morning, when your phone demands your attention, or your digital feed tries to make you angry, or your workplace demands your total urgency over a meaningless metric, pause and ask yourself, am I serving life right now, or am I just serving the vessel?
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take those five guardrail questions into your week, trust your viability sensing, and we will see you next time.